Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening. You caught me drinking some water here. It's just awesome to see you live right here in the most beautiful, this behind me, beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas. And this is the Texas Medical Center, where I work there at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital in the OB-GYN department. I just love that place, and I spend a lot of part of my life in that place. But welcome to this program this evening. We're going to have part two of a guest that came on just a few weeks ago. And we've had lots of requests, a lot of comments, lots of thoughts about what she had to share in her new book. And we're going to be telling you about the book. And we'll do a little recap to catch you up in case you missed it. But in the archives at BBC Radio, or you can go right on the Shattered. Oh, we are live on the Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page. All those programs are right there. Go back and listen to interview number one. Then you can catch up on interview number two. If you want to know more information, that'd be an awesome way to catch up on all the life story of this awesome, awesome individual that wrote a very, and I've read it through and scanned it through the first time, and I read it through completely, and I plan on reading it again. Just a great, great book, and we'll let you know who that is and what that book is and how you can get your hands on it. And we were chit-chatting right before the program. We come on about, 4 minutes with the radio station, and we pass into all the, so we were just talking and chatting and enjoying each other. And we were talking about if this was in audio book format or not. But also we'll talk to you and share with you maybe some ways you can have our guests tonight come and be with you, at least via Zoom or even live in person, to be able to share the story. And it's an awesome story. Not the kind of stories we share very often. A lot of ours deal with deep pain and hurt and abuse. This is a little different journey in life, but it has a lot of life goals in it and a lot of life-changing principles that we can apply in our life. And I think that's where we're going to peel back this layer this evening with our guest. I'm getting ready to, just as soon as we say good night, thank you for being with us tonight. I am going to probably take a shower, change clothes, and get on the road and travel, drive all the way to Abilene, Texas tonight, because 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to be speaking to the teachers, a whole bunch of teachers in Abilene, Texas, and it's our annual teacher training, and we will be with them all day tomorrow. Then I'll jump back in the car, head back to Houston, about 6-7 hour drive and each way, and then be at work before the sun comes up on Tuesday morning. But that'd be right Tuesday morning. So the next time I get to sleep will be sometime Tuesday night. But anybody be thinking of me? But if you want to come to Abilene and get in on the education, come on up, because we're going to be talking about how to deal with all in all about adverse childhood experiences. We're going to find out how to recognize it in your children and how to overcome the aftermath, what toxic stress can do to a person, how to create an environment of trauma-informed sensitivity, and then also what is vicarious trauma, what happens when things happen to you in your everyday life, walk in life, and what happens when it triggers something. Can it have an effect on us? Can it actually take us places we don't expect? Right in the middle of a zippity-doo-dah day, something happens and it ends up grabbing us and bringing us back to something that happened to us in the past and how to overcome that. We're going to be talking about that all day tomorrow. So it's going to be great. But so, how do you actually heal from emotional wounds? This is something that I deal with all the time. A matter of fact, I'm writing my third or fourth book. I think this is my fourth book on embracing your scars, embracing the hurts. How can you turn the hurts, the pain, into purpose and power in your life? And hopefully that's going to come out sometime during the summer months. But how do you deal and overcome and heal from the pain that has happened to you? One of the things that I have learned in the last several years, because I was quiet on this and silent on this, and our guest and I, Barbara, were just saying, hey, she'd like to speak more. Because actually, when you share your story, it helps you heal. It applies another layer of healing salve on a scar, on a hurt that can help us actually overcome. So I have found out, especially in the last year, that the more I speak, the better I get, not at speaking, but the better I get about how to deal with my own pain. And it helps me heal. And I need to understand that sometimes the best way that I can get through a day is I have to become my own best friend. Sometimes I'm on the other side. Sometimes I'm that, Fred Flintstone when he had the little red devil over here and the little angel over here, both whispering in his ear in that cartoon series. Sometimes I could be my worst enemy, but I need to also be my best friend. And in that, I need to realize I need to be kind to myself, take time to refresh, restore, renew, rejuvenate, all of those re's. And try to become a better person. That's hard. There's days that I revert back to the old ways. And in the middle of all that, I need to understand and try to maybe ask myself a question. Just sit back and go, hey, what can I learn from all of this? Instead of saying, hey, God, why did you put me through this? Instead, I need to reframe that question. What can I learn from this experience? How can I be stronger? How can I be better? And every now and then in my journal, I have journals all over the house. I have a whole stack of them right here on the dining room table. I journal sometimes a letter to me. Hey, Greg, this is what I wish you knew when you were 6 or 7. This is what I wish you knew you could go through. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger is that old famous song by Kelly Clarkson. But does it? It's up to you. It's a choice that you can make. And sometimes you have to make that choice every day when you wake up in the morning. There's days that I have to make that choice every hour. Hey, I can choose depression. I can choose to be bitter, or I can choose to keep on keeping on. I've also learned that there's power not only in sharing your story, not only being your own best friend, not only understanding what you can learn, but folks, there's power in apologies, forgiveness. And you have to say, hey, wait, that person hurt me. I'm never going to forgive them. That's your choice. I'm all right. But here's something that I've learned recently that I think would be huge, it was for me, is not only try to forgive them, but wait, forgive yourself for all the things that you've done wrong that you wish you could go back and do better. This is a world of the Frank Sinatra My Way song, regrets. I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. Regrets. I really don't have that many, because I've learned to apologize to myself, and that is huge. And if you can do that for yourself, You can do that for other people too. That's come into your life, hurt you, or you've accidentally hurt them. Be kind to yourself. And then try to have an open outlook on the day. When you wake up in the morning, before your feet hit the floor, choose happiness, choose joy. Let that be the thing that carries you through the day. And then what I'm going to try to do and tell myself all the way throughout the night when I'm driving all night long, I want to be the best version that I can be of myself when I get to Abilene tomorrow morning. I want to be the best that I can be for them and give them more than what they ever expected and share about more than what I ever have. And try to find something that I can give them and help them with. Because when I get back in the car tomorrow afternoon and start driving back, I want to make sure I did my best. Because I am somebody special. You are somebody special. Take that masterpiece and let's knock it up a notch and be one close step closer to what you want to be to give them something that is very, very special. And give your friends that, give your husband or your wife that, and please give your children that. They deserve that. Okay, that's enough of my soapbox. I'm going to kick it out of the way. I am so pleased tonight to have with us the author of this book. Write this book down. The title of this, My American Dream. And this is a picture of her. I'm going to bring Barbara in. Come on in, Barbara. Barbara Feigen,
Hi.
and I believe it's pronounced because we have Feigen Center at the hospital. Is it
Oh,
Feigen?
okay. Fagan.
Feigen. Okay, I had three
Fagan.
ways to pronounce it. I missed all three. Okay, Barbara Feigen. Barbara Sommer Feigen, Feigin. You can order this right now. But the little subtitle, A Journey from Fascism to Freedom. Where did you come up with the title?
I really, the story is a story of my parents, who my Jewish father, my Lutheran mother, and I, who escaped from Nazi Germany in July of 1940 when I was 2 years old. And I really didn't know anything about, I knew that we'd escape, but I knew no details about the escape at all. My parents never spoke about it. I never asked any questions. I was a little German-speaking refugee girl who wanted nothing more than to become an authentic American. That was my focus. So I didn't talk to them about the escape. And just a few years ago, a very few years ago, I learned of a journal that my father had kept in the prelude to the escape and throughout the escape itself. And this was a really terrifying, horrific time when Jews were being persecuted. They had no idea whether they'd be able to get out, how they'd be able to get out. It was a scary, scary time. All of which I learned about when I read this journal, which was just the most. It was really a shocking experience to me to learn what my parents had gone through. And they so appreciated being in the land of the free when we finally got to America. They valued that so much. My father actually says in his journal, in the land of the free, we can be who we want to be, we can do what we want to do. We can go where we want to go. We can think what we want to think, read what we want to read, really discuss different opinions about different things, all of which was not happening in Germany at the time my parents left. So, my mother talked about the American dream. We were kind of living in our own small little way, the American dream. And that's really what inspired me to call my book, My American Dream. Now everybody has their own dream and they kind of have their own thoughts about what their dream might be. But this story is really about me and my family, initially my parents and later on my own kids and grandchildren and my husband and so on, and my life, which is my American dream. So that's how it all came about. And it was a journey from fascism to freedom. And the freedom is what allowed the American dream to really be manifested, to come into reality.
Do you think the younger generation is missing the impact of what a few generations ago experienced, and they don't take the seriousness of it quite as important as they should?
Well, I think they have such a different life experience. I think there probably is some of that. And that's really one of the impacts that I hope my story will have. I hope it will bring people into my life experience and help them to understand, you know, it isn't always all perfection, as you say. You know, there are bumps in the road and life throws you curves. And you've got to kind of pick yourself up, be resilient, be optimistic, and kind of go for what you really want to have happen for yourself. And I hope that the book really has an educational and an inspirational aspect to it and brings younger people who haven't experienced this in their lives some sense of what it's like and how important it is.
Yeah, and this is just, to me, it's almost like it's the quality of the way you write and the entire story and the journal entries in the front of the book are just a masterpiece. You're just wonderful, putting together of all those. When you found and you had your sister, I believe that's how you discovered
yes,
the journal.
Yes, my sister found it.
When she sent that to you, was there something that as you was going through those pages that was coming to life right off out of your own father's handwriting, which I can't even imagine? Was there something that stood out to you?
Oh, Greg.
That was so powerful.
It was just the most incredible experience. It was such an emotional experience. My father wrote this journal in English, and I have no idea how he was able to do that because he basically spoke German when we came. And not only did he write it in English, but the English is so evocative. You know, you talk about what is the most sort of important part of it. The whole thing drew me into this experience. I was terrified, you know, just as they were terrified. They went on, the three of us, together with 79 other refugees, went on a 17-day train trip. Ships were no longer allowed to go across the Atlantic Ocean at that time. It was so late that there were submarines in the Atlantic Ocean, and there was no more passage available. So we had to go on a train, and it was one of the last trains out of Berlin. And this was a dirty, horrible train. The trip was 17 days through Lithuania, through Russia, including Siberia, through China, parts of Korea, and finally to Japan, and then across the Pacific Ocean. And as he writes this story, I felt it. I felt like I was experiencing it. I can't really even describe it for you any more clearly than that. It took my breath away. It completely took my breath away. I was stunned by it. And the reason that I wrote the book was essentially, initially, for my children, their children, and future generations, because I thought there was so much about my own background that I never knew about. I never want my own kids to be as ignorant of what came before them as I have been, because I think what comes before you is so important in making you who you are. So I wanted them to understand and not have to find a journal of mine many years after my death, So that was the impetus for my writing it. I thought that my kids need to know about this. The journal was the springboard for the rest of the story. And then the rest of the story is really three threads of my own life. My growing up as a little German refugee German speaking girl in a tiny little town in the state of Washington, where there was no one else like us. We were the only people like us. Everybody, it was a town where people had lived for generations, families had lived for generations, very homogeneous population, and we were clearly outliers. And the first part of the story is my fervent wish to become an authentic American girl, just like everybody else. I want to dress like everybody else, not wear the neighbor's hand-me-downs, be like everyone else, have fun, with my friends and so forth. So that's one thread. A second thread is my career. I had a fabulous career in a very male-dominated business in that era, the advertising business, when I found really great success, and I was really kind of the only woman in the room a great deal of the time when I was there, because it was early on, and women were, they just couldn't get jobs. And if they did get jobs, they were probably typists or receptionists or what have you, but they weren't in the professional areas of the business. And then the third thread of my story, which of course I want my kids and my grandchildren and future generations to know about, is the story of my family. My husband, Jim, and our three sons, and we were very, very devoted to building a strong, tight family with really, as I called it, bonds of steel, which served us very well when our family went through difficult times. That was very important to both my husband and me. So that's kind of the third thread of my story.
What's some of the characteristics, some of the values that you hang on to and want to make sure that your family was built on, that you learned from your mom and dad in their unbelievable journey to this country with you? What's some of those things that you want to make
Well,
sure your great, great, great grandchildren have in them too?
my parents really modeled. They didn't talk a lot about their values, but they modeled their values.
Yeah, he lived it.
They lived it, and I learned from them through observing and through osmosis. And they had a really strong value system: honor, integrity, generosity of spirit, courage and bravery, which were very important for them, obviously, as they had to make this terrifying escape. They were very determined and had great perseverance. And I think that's a very important value, which I hope I passed along to my kids. And I think you were talking in your opener about the importance of resilience when you come upon bumps in the road, which we all do. Some are really tough ones and some are small bumps, but they're all bumps. And we have to be resilient, figure out, how do we really get around them or over them or through them or whatever. So resilience and an optimistic spirit, those are all things that my parents really lived. And I really believe very strongly in them, and I hope that I've imparted them to my kids. I think I have.
Yeah.
And they're now parents themselves and have kids who are teenagers and young adults. And I think they're doing the same thing. They're trying to impart those same kinds of values to their own children.
Yeah. How did, 'cause I don't think we talked about this in the first program with you a few weeks ago. How did, when your mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer. How did that get up into your brain and in your way of thinking in your mental health of how am I going to get through this and how did this affect you and your family? Because that is such a devastating diagnosis. How did you overcome that? I'm really interested.
Well, I don't know that you overcome it. You sort of
Deal.
internalize it, you know. My mother was sort of misdiagnosed initially and ultimately was diagnosed with terminal breast cancer when I was 11 years old and my
Wow.
sister was six. And again, we were this little refugee family in Chehalis, Washington, knew nothing. And I remember my father made an appointment with the local sort of the premier attorney in town. You know, he's very well known as being the best attorney in Chehalis. And we went to him and they brought me with them. And, you know, I knew this was a very serious thing, but I didn't quite know what it was all about. And I
Right.
think my father wanted to get guidance from this attorney, whom he respected very much, about how to go forward. You know, my mother was given a diagnosis of 1 year to live. 1 year. I'm 11, my sister is six, and my father is thinking, how am I going to do this? How am I going to bring up these two girls on my own when I'm just barely learning to speak English, you know? I had to take over a lot of the household duties that my mother normally performed. You know, I did the marketing and the cleaning of the house, and I did the laundry and the ironing and so forth. And I didn't think much of it. I just did it. That was the way it was, you know. But the larger answer to your question was that my mother did not die at the end of the year. My mother lived until I was 23 years old. So she lived 12 years. And it was like living on a roller coaster. She would have a crisis, and then she'd have a remission. And then she'd have another crisis. And each time she had a crisis, none of us knew whether she'd come out of this crisis or not. I think it must have been horrendously stressful for my father. It was stressful for all of us. But my mother was such a fighter. And as I reflect, when I was writing my book, I reflected a lot about this. And I thought, you know, I think she really felt she had to live so she could impart the life lessons that she thought were the important ones for her two daughters. And she lived until after I was married, actually. She was able to come to my wedding and to dance with my father at my wedding, which just touched me, you
Oh,
know,
yeah.
absolutely brought tears to my eyes, because we never expected that this would happen. Eventually, we lived in this tiny little town, as I told you. When I was a sophomore in college, I was 18 years old. My parents had to move to Seattle because my mother's medical team was in Seattle. And she was going through all kinds of experimental procedures and all that sort of thing. And Chehalis was 100 miles away from Seattle, and she just couldn't handle the travel, you know. So they moved to Seattle. And they actually had, I guess, maybe 5 or 6 nice years together, my parents, in Seattle before she died. But it was life-changing. I mean, it was a life-changing experience in that, you know, there was always stress. There was always the stress of not knowing, is this the time that it's not going to work out? Is this,
Yeah.
oh boy, she's in remission again, you know, and then the next crisis would come. So, it was a life-changing experience.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that after this commercial break. We're going to take a short break, about 1 minute and 10 seconds. I want to find out what those life lessons were that she hung on for to make sure she passed out to her two girls. We're going to talk
Okay.
about that. 888-627-6008. We'll be right back with the awesome author of this beautiful book, My American Dream. Hang with us. You won't want to miss this last segment. We'll be right back.
HCI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back, Barbara Fagan, author of this book, My American Dream. I highly recommend this. And you was talking in the last segment, Barbara, about your mom hanging on and just being a fighter, not giving up, wanting to make sure she passed that legacy, those life lessons on to you. What's some of the things, because then we're going to talk about your father and the strokes and things he went through. But during those ages, when you were 11 to 24, 25?
23, yeah.
23, and she finally passed. What were some of those lessons that she did instill that you saw in her, in the way she handled things, that you have in the back of your mind that you go, oh, I want to make sure I pass this on too?
Well, I was so interested in your intro today because you talked about some of the things that my mother actually tried to impart to us. One of which was that we should always strive to be the very best we can be at whatever it is that we're doing. She always wanted me to walk tall, be proud, never go for second best, you know, strive for the very best. She really imparted both to my sister and myself, she and my father both felt the importance of education to open doors to opportunity. They believed in that so strongly. Whenever we went on a road trip and we finally were able to go on road trips when my father had saved enough money to buy a car, which was a very big deal in our family, we always went through towns where there were colleges, because they felt we ought to see what colleges are like. And, you know, there was no question but that we were going to go to college. Not everybody in our town did go to college. Not all the kids did go to college. But education was really such an important, powerful door opener to opportunity. And they were very eager for us to kind of try to figure out what kind of opportunity were we interested in pursuing. So that was very important. And undergirding everything, my mother's mantra, which, you know, again, I've taken to heart and I've tried to impart to my own kids, was to dream big, to work hard, and to never quit. And I think that's the way they lived their lives. They came to America. They had no idea how were they going to make a life here, but they had a dream that somehow or another they were going to do that. They would make it work, and they worked very, very hard. They were very determined, and they did make it work. And they never, 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 never quit. They ran into bumps in the road just like we do, but they kept at it. And I think all those things have been important in terms of sort of my own system of values and the way I've tried to live my own life.
And not only personally, but professionally, because you being in a being a woman in a predominantly male environment in advertising marketing, that was huge because you had to make sure you didn't just do it right, that you did it better as and the
And
best you
never,
could
never,
do.
never quit.
Yeah, because there's probably
Keep
days you wanted to
at
just throw up your hands, right?
Well, no, I never did. I think I took from my parents the whole sense of how important optimism was. I always felt positive about being able to get to the next step, one little goal at a time, and it was not a straight line by any means, but I thought, I'm just going to work really hard at doing the very best I can, being the best I can be at this, and then we'll go on to the next piece. And that's kind of the way I did it.
I'm going to throw you a curveball. You hold your mom and dad up, and which is awesome in high regard of people that you respect, learn from. Who in this world right now is a leading model of the type of person, the type of woman that our world needs to be able to look up to for the next
Oh,
generation? Who would some of those
wow.
people be that you hold up to as, hey, there's a good example of what I'm talking about right there.
Well, she's gone now, but I would have said Madeleine Albright.
Yeah, yes.
Definitely would be one. There are a number of women who have done very well in business. I mean, business is a little more open to women now than it was when I came out.
Right.
And I think the president CEO of General Motors, Mary Barrett, the fact that she's been able to do what she's done in that business, which is a very male-driven business, I think is quite amazing. So that's another one. I have to think, who are the role models?
Isn't that something that we do have to sit back and think? Who's
And
that role,
think,
some of those role models? Because
Michelle
there's,
Obama.
okay, they're few and far between, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of women who have done a lot of very good things, but I was trying to think sort of holistically. Who's got the
Yeah.
whole package? So that's a handful of them.
Yeah. When your father lost your mom and cancer finally took her, how hard was that for you to be there, deal with that, and then with your dad, you had already probably stepped into that role of being the caretaker, but then when he started having health issues, that caretaker role even took a more steep upgrade, correct?
Well, no, it was my husband who had the strokes.
Oh, your husband. Okay, I'm sorry. My
No,
apologies.
that's okay. When my mother died, I was very concerned about my father because my father had really lived all these years just focused on my mother's health, and kind of
Yeah.
getting through that whole period. And at the time, I was living in New York, and I had my life in New York. I was married. I had children, maybe not kids yet, but I was married. And my sister was going to college in Washington, D.C. And I thought, oh my gosh, my father's going to be all alone. This is, and I felt very helpless. I thought, I don't know how to be helpful to him. And so, an interesting little twist, it turned out that my father, about a year later, married my mother's sister, and people said to me, "Oh my gosh, your father's marrying your mother's sister. How do you feel about that?" And I said, "You know, I feel terrific about that because I think he needs to have someone in his life, and he's decided that this is going to work for him, and he deserves to be happy and to relax and enjoy and, you know, have a good next chapter in his life." And that's what happened. So, and then, you know, you were talking about being a caregiver.
Yeah.
When my husband was in the prime of his life, 54 years old, I woke up on a Saturday morning. Our routine was that he would usually bring me a cup of coffee in bed on Saturday.
Your husband brought you a cup of coffee in bed.
My husband brought me a
you
cup of
coffee. You got a good one.
I had a fabulous husband.
You had a good one.
Yeah. And he I saw him walking into our bedroom, and he was dragging his foot, and he was kind of holding the coffee in this weird way. His hand was sort of all clutched up like this. And I thought, oh my goodness, something bad is happening. I think he's having a stroke. It was a Saturday morning in July. There are no doctors around in New York on Saturday mornings in July. So I had to sort of scramble around and find a doctor who would see him. And I finally did, got him to the doctor. And the doctor saw him and said immediately, "Mr. Fagan, you are having a stroke. Not you've had a stroke, but you are having a stroke. You need to get to the ER immediately." And then he pulled me aside and he said, "Mrs. Fagan, your life will never be the same." And truer words were never spoken. This was shattering. This was a shattering experience for my husband, of course. He was only 54 at the prime of his life, you know, had a big business career. And I just had no idea. I was just stupefied. Had no idea how to deal with this. It was so terrifying, and life was never the same. It was always before and after Jim's stroke. You know, I said before, we'd always worked to really develop strong bonds among our boys and ourselves. You know, we had and have a very strong family. And that really saved us, I think, because we were all able to support Jim and one another during a really terrifying, awful time. Jim was paralyzed on one side pretty seriously. Fortunately, he did not lose his speech and he didn't lose his mental faculties. Thank goodness, thank goodness. But he was never able to work again. He was never able to really be independent. And I kind of had to take over everything in our family. You know, I had to clearly look after him and his health and well-being. But I became the sole breadwinner of the family. I handled all the financial affairs, all of our family affairs, everything. And, you know, as I was writing this book, I really was thankful that I felt competent to be able to do all this, you know. So 10 years later, he had a second stroke. And it was in the same part of his brain as the initial one, which meant that all of his problems were exacerbated. And at that point, he really couldn't do anything on his own anymore. You know, couldn't stand up, couldn't sit down, couldn't walk, couldn't do anything. Terrible balance problems and so on. And I was his caregiver for 25 years. And this happened when he was 54 years old. He died when he was 79 years old. So our lives were never the same, as the doctor had said. But we got through it. You know, we got through it. We took us it took us a long time to adjust to a different life, but we did.
Where do you find the strength to do that?
I don't know. I don't know.
Do you
Again,
know? So, do you agree with the statement that people don't know how strong they are until they have no choice to go through it and fight through it?
well, I never thought about that very much. Certainly, that was true for me. I think that my experience with my mother probably helped me, again, subconsciously, to deal with what I had to deal with. But this was I was like a zombie for a whole year. I was crazy, crazy. I just could not imagine that this had actually happened. It was very, very tough.
So how long in your career did you go with all this stuff still happening at the house? You said you became the primary breadwinner. How much longer did you work before retiring out?
I worked, let me see. I worked probably this was 25 years that, you know, after he had his stroke, I probably worked for 20 of those years.
Wow.
Yeah. And this was a time when, you know, I was really sort of taking on more and more responsibility in my career and going on some New York Stock Exchange corporate boards and what have you. And I was very grateful to have the work that I was doing, which I loved. And I worked with people whom I really respected and liked, and we all worked very well together. And I really thought to myself, you know, when I go to work, I work on problems that I can solve. At home, I'm in a situation where I can't do anything to be helpful. I mean, I can help my husband get through the day, but I can't really help him get back to the man he had been, you know, which was really difficult for him.
When he finally passed, how did you have and how did you deal with becoming the new barber, the widow? How did you overcome that, and what wisdom do you have?
You said when we talked before, you said, you know, you got to just keep on keeping on. And that's what I did. I was very fortunate because, you know, at that time, I'd gone to college at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, small private
Wow.
liberal arts school. And they invited me to become a trustee. And it was right at the time that Jim died. And I thought, oh, you know, this will be good. And they were in the process. They had a new president. They were going to develop a new strategic plan. They had to relook at their whole governance organization and operations. And these were all areas where I had expertise, both from my work at Gray and from my corporate board work. And I thought, gee, I can kind of get my teeth into this. And so that was great because it was a wonderful way to feel like I was doing something that mattered. I was meeting wonderful new people who were really smart and terrific to work with and so on. So that was one important thing that I did. And then, you know, not too long after Jim died, I learned about my father's journal. And I began to think, you know, I really need to figure out, like, should I write a book? A lot of people over the years had said to me, I should write a book. And I said, I wouldn't even know what to write about. I wouldn't even know how to start. And I thought, you know, I really do have to write this for my children because, as I said before, I didn't want them to be ignorant as I had been. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to really try to do this. And I got a coach who helped me a little bit, you know, to sort of think through what I wanted to do. And so that was something else that I kind of got into. So I looked for things where I could really jump in and sort of devote myself to and try to make a difference that mattered. That always was important to me.
Yeah. If you had to look back on your life, you say, hey, this is the one thing that I am so glad that I accomplished. And I feel so good about this one thing in my life. What would that be for you?
My three sons.
Your three sons.
My three sons. Yes, absolutely. I'm very proud of them. They're terrific people. They're terrific men, great husbands, devoted fathers, caring sons. And they as one of them said at one of Jim's birthday parties, they learned from the best. That was my husband.
Yeah, and this is a picture. Is this a picture of your family?
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful family. As we close out, just because I want to make sure I get the entire story, how many pages was this journal?
Approximately? Oh, gosh.
I mean, was it this thick or this thick?
No. I would say maybe 30.
30 pages?
I don't know for sure, but I would not.
Did you ever think about printing one of the pages of the handwritten pages with these writings for people like me that could actually see? Because you have such awesome pictures in here to see a picture of.
I didn't have it. My sister had it. And, you know, I said to her, you know, I went on this trip with my family. Don't you think I should have it? And she was not eager to give it up. But I finally got it, but the book was already underway at that time, so I couldn't do it. But yes, that would have been a great idea.
I'd love to see just the page, just to feel
the next
what
edition.
This is all about. The next edition. There you go. Here's the book. This is the softbound copy, and she has the hardbound copy right there. You can also get it on the ebook version. I like the cover of yours better. It's got a little pinkish purple.
Pinkish, skin. Right.
Anyway, my American dream. And do you have another book in you?
I don't know. We'll see.
You may.
I don't know. I want to do a little speaking first.
There you go. And if you want to get a hold of Barbara Fagan, how would they get a hold of you, Barbara, if they want to invite you?
Go to my website, Barbara Fagan, F-E-I-G-I-N, all lowercase, all one word, .com. That's my website. Has lots of information about the book and about me. And you can actually order the book from the website. So please do that and enjoy it and hopefully be inspired by it. I'd love to inspire at least one person. That
well,
would make me feel like
me.
I made a difference.
People all the way around the world, I get emails and texts from the last show, and I'm looking right now again. There's just text after text of people saying thank you so much, and they appreciate you. And you should have been on the cover of Time Magazine as one of the greatest women in our country.
Thank you.
What
thank
you've gone
you,
through
you.
And what you are laying down for generations in your own family and the people around you. Thank you, Barbara, for being with us.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. It's just been wonderful to be with you.
It's a joy. Thank you. We'll talk to you later. God bless you.
Okay.
Thank you. As we do each and every week, I always like to end the program with the same thought, and I hope it does become redundant because I don't want you ever to forget it. No matter what you're dealing with right now, no matter if you're the little girl on the book like here and you wonder what's the next step, what's the next day going to look like, and you're a stranger in a new country, no matter what it is, I want to let you know there's always hope. Never, never give up on hope. Keep slinging sweat, keep moving forward, keep making an impact on people, keep being the best that you can be. Think of me, if you will, for the rest of the evening and all night long as I'm driving to Abilene. And Abilene, tighten your seatbelts because I'm coming. And we'll be there first thing in the morning to be able to talk with you and all those teachers. It's going to be awesome. Join us right here next week. The next few weeks, we have some awesome guests. Don't miss an episode. Right here on Breaking the Silence in the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas. God bless you. Have an awesome week. Take care. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.